ended up last Thursday. We'd already shown that the Blaschke condition was necessary for the zero set of any Nevin-Lena function. And conversely, not only is it sufficient for the zero set of a Nevin-Lena function, it's sufficient for the zero set of an H-infinity function, a very special one called a Blaschke product. Obviously, each factor has modulus at most 1, so if the product converges to anything other than this identically zero function, they will have norm equal to or less than 1, and the main conclusion is that the zero set of this Blaschke product is precisely what you want. It's the zeros alpha n with the right multiplicity. So now we want to continue and now show that, well, first of all, the theory of Poisson integral, which remember I'm assuming that we know, the theory of the Poisson integral applies, of course, to harmonic functions. And for bounded harmonic functions, they're the integral of their boundary limits with the Poisson current. So the theory of Poisson integrals shows that V star EI theta, because of course holomorphic functions are harmonic, shows that V star, the limit exists almost everywhere. So that's V star EI theta. Almost every theta. And of course, because it's bounded of norm 1, we get B star EI theta equal to or less than 1 almost everywhere. So the next theorem, of course, is to show that, in fact, we get equality almost everywhere. Can't be smaller on a non-negligible set. So the theorem. With B as above, we get B star EI theta equals 1 almost every theta. And moreover, the stronger statement is that the integral of limit r goes to 1 over 2 pi minus pi to pi log modulus b r EI theta d theta I think I just want to say equals 0, or do I want to say it equals something else that equals 0? No, just 0. Okay, so the proof. The proof is to note that this integral is certainly monotone increasing by Jensen's formula. Remember, Jensen's formula said that this thing actually equaled something specific. Yes, it's always bounded by zero, yes. So, and in fact, the limits exist almost everywhere. So in fact, if we can show that this integral actually equals zero, then we can't have the limits B star being less than zero on a set of positive measure. So the proof, the integral log B R E I theta is non-decreasing by Jensen's formula. Simply because the left-hand side of Jensen's formula obviously goes up. Okay, and then what do we do? Now, apply the Fatou's lemma. To the only non-negative function around, which is log 1 over the REI theta. that thing. So of course this guy, because the b is equal to or less than 1 in modulus, this log will be equal to or greater than 0. To get, well, what do you get? We get that the integral 1 over 2 pi minus pi to pi of the log, and now of course inside Fatou's lemma says inside you have the lim-inf. But the lim-inf of these, but the limit actually exists, so the lim-inf is actually the limit almost everywhere. So that's b star ei theta is equal to or less than the lim-inf of the integrals. So lim-inf r goes to 1. Of course, you do this for sequences, but it works for all sequences, so let's write it as a continuous limit, r goes to 1. Lim-inf of, and then you get the integral, 1 over 2 pi minus pi to pi log EREI theta. And so now we use, oh, I forgot to mention something, but now we're going to use Jensen's formula again. But before we do that, we should probably notice the following. Note that if we write, and this will be a standard notation for us, if we write the Blaschke product as a product of a finite part up to capital N times the tail, so this will be, so the finite part, you just take the product this far, that's the bn, and then the pn is the rest of it. Split it up like this. So if we write it like this, you'll note that this part, because this is a rational function with poles away from the circle, so if we write this, then, well, actually log even modulus bn, this function, is smooth near the circle T, and it's actually vanishes there. It vanishes at T, or vanishes on T. In other words, it's a nice function. I mean, after all, this, if you look at the definition somewhere, here, if you only go up to finitely many places, this is a perfectly nice rational function. Now, when Z is on the circle T, this is a, well, let's just say it's a quotient of polynomials. And the log modulus has been a nice, smooth function, and in fact vanishes on T. So, we can replace B by the tail, Pn, without changing the limit of B star. That's right.
So if each bn vanishes at every point of the boundary, how come that for some theta the limit will not vanish there? I mean, we have the modulus of the boundary value equal to 1 only for almost every theta. Why not for every theta?
Well, because the bn's have a restriction, a continuous function on the circle, but the convergence is not uniform on the circle. The convergence is uniform on all compact subsets of the open disk. So if you take the disk and you take any compact subset, we usually take a ball of radius r strictly less than 1, then these products converge uniformly there. So any niceness of the products is preserved, relatively speaking, especially with Cauchy's formula, everything is preserved. But at the boundary, you don't have uniform convergence, so you... the continuous functions can just converge pointwise almost everywhere to something.
Well, even pointwise convergence on the boundary. because otherwise
we're not uniform. We have pointwise almost everywhere convergence.
Almost everywhere, but not everywhere.
No. It's sort of like just taking a bunch of continuous functions and having them approach pointwise almost everywhere a characteristic function. Right? The characteristic function is not continuous. It's not nice. Because the convergence is bad. The convergence is not uniform. So that's why we have to fuss with the PN. Because the PN, of course, should go to zero. But it doesn't go to zero uniformly. Yes?
About the Parsons lemma, you apply for a lot of 1 over, so you get difficult. It should be bigger than this one.
Yes. This one goes the wrong way. Yeah. First of all, it's not true. And second, it's not what we want. Thank you. Yes, I'm applying it to that. So all of this is 1 over. Okay.
So what's the minus sign when we get bigger than or equal than the principle?
Yeah. Right, so in fact, if we take it over to the other side, we get lim sup, r goes to 1, which we know is the limit because it's monotone increasing. So I should have done that. I got myself confused. So you take it to the other side, you get lim sup of the integral, 1 over 2 pi, minus pi to pi, log, and now the thing we want, b, REI theta d theta equal to or less than this one. B star EI theta d theta. And again, this we already know from the first observation that this is actually limit as R goes to infinity. R goes to 1. Okay. So, what we have to do now is show that it's actually pushed all the way up. So, we can replace B by PN without changing the limit. So, by Jensen's formula again, but applied to PN, so by Jensen's formula, applied to PN, what do we get? We get PN of 0 I should look it up, make sure I get it right. Log PN of 0. Right, that log, because you take away the other factors, is equal to or less than the limit r goes to 1 over 2 pi, minus pi to pi, and here, technically, we get the log of pn, rei theta, d theta, but the bn for a fixed n is a nice smooth function, so I can put the bn back in. Doesn't change the limit because b log bn. In other words, you can add log bn. It's a smooth function, won't affect the limit, and so we can add it back in. So this is the limit. R goes to 1 over 2 pi. And then you can put in here still log B REI theta. Which is equal to or less than that thing, which is equal to or less than 0. And now the only thing that remains to do is to show that this goes to 0. But of course it does. This. But the log is goes to 0 as n goes to infinity by the inequality that we had before. There's this general inequality. Well, I guess it was for an m. Actually, it was for infinity too. Of 1 minus un is bigger than the exponential of, and then you put a factor of 2 in, provided things were small enough, and you get the sum n equals this type of thing. And the idea is that in the pn, if you evaluate pn at 0, if you evaluate pn at 0, of course you're starting the product of capital N, you put 0 in, you're just getting the modulus of alpha n. That's the 1 minus un. That's the 1 minus un, which, of course, is convergent. Or sorry, the alpha n is the 1 minus un, so therefore the 1 minus alpha n, which is the un, is convergent. And so this goes to 1, and well, that says, tells you that as n goes to infinity, this product goes to 1, so the log goes to 0. And of course, that's what squeezes this limit, the one we want, forces this limit to be 0. And then somewhere along the way, we had shown this. So this is 0, and so is this. This one, of course, was 1 over 2 pi. Shouldn't have erased it. It's log b star r I theta. Sorry, just e I theta, no r. So now, since this goes to 0, we now know that both of these are 0. So this equals 0 plus this equals 0. The fact that this equals 0 and the integrand is equal to or less than 0, almost everywhere, actually, shows you that the shows you that the integrand must be 0 almost everywhere, because otherwise you get a negative answer. So it's that squeeze that does everything. So I think the answer to your question about why don't we get that B star is equal to 1 almost everywhere just from the fact that the BNs are nice, it's this right here, this trick that's going on. The fact that we have from Jensen's formula, we can apply it to the tail, and because the BN is nice, the tail is the same as the whole thing, but this part goes to 1. Of course, the B doesn't. B of 0 is whatever it is. So it's the fact that we can force this left-hand side up that pushes this integral. Otherwise, you don't. So I think that's the key to the proof. Maybe we'll leave that on the board. Well, now that we have this, a lot of stuff comes easy. Once you know that Blaschke products have modulus 1 almost everywhere on the boundary, you can divide out by them. So now we can divide out the zeros of an HP function. So here's a corollary. Suppose 0 less than p, less than infinity, and f is an HP. Let's assume it's not identically 0. Then, of course, its 0 set will be a set that's isolated in D. The zeros can only accumulate at the boundary. So suppose an f is an A. Then, if B is the Blaschke product associated to the zero set of f, the function g equals f divided by b, which of course, it's going to be holomorphic. Remember, f has some zeros. The Blaschke product, by our main theorem just a while ago, has exactly the same zeros then as F with exactly the same multiplicities. So therefore, all these singularities are removable. And G is therefore at least holomorphic. And the claim of the theorem is that not only is it holomorphic, it's actually an HP with the same norm. And the function G is an HP with the HP norm the same as the FP norm. He's going to leave that. So the proof of this should be simple. Well, I've already explained part of it. Clearly, G is holomorphic in the open unit disk because we've all the zero, the same, where there used to be zeros, and we divided by the Blaschner product with the same zeros, they're all removable. We also know that B is equal to or less than 1. So in modulus, G is a bigger function. It looks bigger. So obviously, G is equal to or greater than F in D. Actually, if B is not a constant, it's actually strictly bigger, but we don't need to know that in D. And that implies that the LP norm of G, which remember is the limit R goes to 1 of these things. You just take R dI theta d theta. And of course that's going to be equal to or greater than the corresponding thing for F, because G is bigger than F inside. Of course in the limit, as we'll show in a moment, they turn out to be equal, these things. So G is equal to or greater than that. Conversely, well, you factor out the good function again. So conversely, F over BN. So here, you remember what BN is. You take the product of the Blaschke product up to the capital N non-zero zero and stop there. So certainly this function still has some zeros left, the ones in the tail. But in particular, we have a bunch of things. First of all, this is in HP, and of course its norm in HP is equal to that of F, and that's a gain, because same reason as before, because BN is smooth near T, in some neighborhood of T, and is 1 on T. And equals 1 on the circle. So if you just look at this definition of the limb here, the limit, if you replace the G by F over BN here, the BN in the limit is not going to have any effect. It's nice and smooth. The limit goes smoothly. It's equal to 1. So it has no effect on the limit. So you have this. And from that, I'll just switch the boards. And now you just use the fact that F over BN, while it's in modulus, while it's still equal to or greater than F, it's equal to or less than G, and it approaches G in modulus from underneath, monotonically. So you can apply the monotone convergence theorem. Since F over BN increases to F over B, because you just multiply by more stuff that's less than 1 inside, that equals G inside D. Since that happens, we get from the monotone convergence theorem that um, Well, for each fixed R, this goes to that. And, of course, the sup of these things is equal to that of F. I got this going in the right direction. Okay, since the Fn or Bn goes to G, we get that what? F over Bn to the P for each fixed R, how should I write that? F over Bn. Remember, that symbol means you evaluate at Rz instead. So we get that that thing increases to 1 over 2 pi times that thing, and that thing is equal to or less than G something seems to be going the wrong way. F over Bn. Oh, I'm going to look. I can't think when I get stuck. I'll just look and see what happens. And then we'll verify that you're probably right. But so gr of p, which I wrote down there, is the limit of the f's. And that's equal to less than f. I did it. I should have written this the other way around, and it would have been obvious what to do. So what I should have done was write that that is the limit as n goes to infinity of that. Bn r. And this is equal to or less than limit, or at least the limit for, or the lim sup or something, of because each one of these things is equal to or less than the HP norm of F over BN. But the HP norm of F over BN is HP norm of F. So you just get HP norm of F. So you get that. So if I take this away, that does it, because now you take the sup of these. Yeah. I guess that's what you were saying. Okay. So that implies that GP equal to or less than FP. Yes, yes, everywhere here is P. Thank you. Everywhere is P. I got the P up there. Okay. Okay, so that's one easy corollary. Another one. So there's about three more easy things to get from this. The next one is the factorization of HP. So another corollary. If 0 less than P equal to or less than infinity, oh yeah, so the case P equals infinity I just leave as exercises all the time. I mean, I'm assuming that, I guess that here I was tacitly assuming that P was between 0 and infinity. If P satisfies this range, and F is an HP, then there is a Blaschka product B, and H in H2, non-vanishing in D, such that F is equal to B times H to the maybe it's the other way. I can never remember. 2 over P. Right. Such that this happens. Okay, so the proof for this is you let B be the Blaschka product associated to the zeros of F. So of course we can divide out by it. Then F over B is still, by the previous corollary, is still in HP and it's non-vanishing. And of course a non-vanishing holomorphic function in a simply connected domain like D has a logarithm. So you can write this as E to the phi, for phi holomorphic. Okay, so this is just standard holomorphic function theory on the disk, complex analysis. And now, we know that F over B, being an HP, we know that when you integrate on circles, F over B to the pth power, satisfies the soup is finite, so that means E to the P phi will satisfy that. And if we take the square root of that, then the squares of that will satisfy it. So it's P over 2. Then set H equal to E to the P over 2 times phi. That's clearly holomorphic, and in fact, H to the P H2 H squared is equal to E to the P phi modulus, which is F over B. And of course, since the averages of these things are uniformly bounded, so that implies H is an H2. Okay, so once you have a non-vanishing holomorphic function, you just take roots to get it in the right LP space, right? I think some article with that. And then what do we do? And then I guess you just notice that this the conclusion must be true. F is equal to B times E to the phi, which is B H to the 2 over P. Oh, and I forgot to mention the part that is used most often. Maybe I'll stick it up here. It can be fitted in, at least on my board. The special case P equals 1. If F is in H1, if F is in H1, then F equals GH with G and H2, G and H both in H2, and the H1 norm of F is H2 norm. That. And to prove that part, so if F is an H1, take G to be equal to BH, that's just trivial. I mean, just BH, and then what's left is another H. So it's just BH and H. And of course, this is in this is an H2, and of course H is an H2. Now, so that's the factorization of H1 functions as a product of H2 functions. And this turns out to be an extremely useful fact.
Why do we like the two, the numbers two? Why not so that F is B times some H1 function to the power of 1?
Yeah.
It's also?
Yeah, I mean, once you have non-vanishing functions, you can go up and down the scale. The reason we take H2 is that H2, being the Hilbert space, has all sorts of extra properties. And this factorization of H1 as a product of H2s is very special and will give us an incredibly important result, the F and M Ries theorem. You see, normally, if you work in the world of harmonic Poisson integrals, I mean, one of the big results at the end that we'll do today, for Poisson integrals, if you have harmonic functions, whose peak means are uniformly bounded, then they're given as the Poisson integral of an LP function on the boundary. That's the theory of the Poisson integral. And that works for P strictly bigger than 1. It fails when P equals 1. You get measures. And, of course, the measures can have singular parts. It's an arbitrary measure. This factorization will tell us that for an H1 function, the measure you get must actually be the product of the boundary measures of two H2 functions. So, in other words, it'll be an L1 function, because L2 times L2 is L1. So we'll end up proving that the boundary measure associated with an H1, the one you get from Poisson integral theory, isn't an arbitrary measure. It's actually absolutely continuous. And that's a major step forward. It's because in the harmonic theory you don't see the conjugate function hanging around. But anyway, so this factorization turns out to be extremely useful for giving you the extra properties for holomorphic functions. Okay, so that was the factorization. Oh yeah. So now is the corollary on the boundary behavior. Okay, I was just anticipating all that a second ago. So the boundary behavior. Well, I've just finished mentioning, it's a good preamble to this corollary. From the theory of the Poisson integral, you can immediately deduce that for HP functions with P bigger than 1, they're given by Poisson integrals of LP functions on the boundary, because holomorphic is harmonic. So you instantly get that. It fails for P equals 1, and of course for P less than 1, there was nothing for harmonic functions. There will be something here, however, because of this corollary with the H to the 2 over P. It'll give us a boundary value theory even for P's less than 1 when we wouldn't expect one, plus it gives us a better theory than we would have gotten from harmonic even at P equals 1. So the boundary behavior theorem is this. Suppose 0 less than P equals less than infinity, and F in HP. Then the non-tangential maximal function of F at EI theta, which is defined to be the limit. Well, so here's EI theta. And let's just take a ball, say, of radius a half here, and take the convex hull of EI theta and this thing. And so we want Z to be in there. So we want Z to be in there, and Z should run toward EI theta. So this is stronger than the radial limits, right? We're not just taking the limit as R goes to 1 of REI theta. We're allowing it to go a little bit to each side, but you'll notice this is a non-tangential region. This is a positive angle here. And you can, it doesn't, you can take any size thing here. I just, it's one of those, make it fixed. So actually there's a family of non-tangential maximal functions, which I guess is, the bigger this thing is, of course, the harder it is to have convergence, but it still will always converge almost everywhere, that's what I'll say. So then NF equals the limit of that. I actually want to use this for the maximal function. So what do I then, maybe I'll call it this. F star is this limit, exists almost everywhere, or almost every theta, in T. And NF, the non-tangential maximal function, I think I said the word maximal, but then I didn't. This is equal to the soup over Z's in the same region. Z's in the same thing, ending at EI theta. Modulus of Z, F of Z. And this thing is in, is in LP. D theta. Actually, let me see how much of this we want. NF is in LP. The non-tangential limits exist almost everywhere. Of course, F star is an LP, and then the boundary convergence. So that happens, this happens, and in parentheses I'll just say, and so F star is an LP. That's because obviously the limit is equal to or less than the soup. That's obviously clear. And I guess this is the most important one. If we look at F sub R, that's you restrict F to the slightly smaller circle of radius R, subtract F star, look at it in the LP norm on the circle. That converges to zero as R goes to one. Oh, and of course from this follows the obvious thing, and F star in the LP norm is F in the HP norm. Because obviously then the LP norm of F star is the limit of these LP norms of FRs, which was defined to be that thing, because it was monotone. And there's one more statement in this thing. One more statement is that for F, see, what you would like to do is recover F from its boundary values by some integral formula. Well, the only hope you have, really, for doing that is when P is equal to or greater than 1, because you want F star to be integrable. Otherwise, what do you do? I guess there are things you can do, but the obvious thing is to take P equal to or greater than 1. And the biggest space of all the HPs for p equal to greater than 1 is, of course, h1. Right? As p gets up, as p increases, the space is smaller. So if f is in h1, this is the largest space for which we have a hope of recovering f from its boundary values. The assertion is that, yes, you can recover it from its boundary values using either of the two obvious ways to do it, the Poisson integral or the Cauchy integral. So f is in h1, then f is equal to, they call it the Cauchy integral of f equals the Poisson integral of f stars. And, of course, there's formulas for both of these things. I'll write them out in a second. But that's the end of the statement of the corollary.
For each layer is smaller than one, we cannot recover function from boundary.
I think from what I remember, the boundary values are actually distributions.
Uh-huh.
So you can recover them from the distribution boundary value, but they're more than just the LP functions. It's been a long time since I've actually looked at the HP theory with p less than 1. But, yeah, it's a little tricky. A little tricky. So the proof. Okay, so for p bigger than 1, we're done. All of this follows from the theory of the Poisson integral and harmonic functions. So now you see how much we've been assuming all along. When I say we assume the theory of the Poisson integral, we're assuming quite a bit. All that non-tangential maximal function stuff. And the covering lemmas and all that. But it's basically real analysis. But we can't do everything, so. So all of this follows from the theory of the Poisson integral. Our conclusion doesn't follow when p is equal to or less than 1. As I said, when p equals 1, you get measures, and for p less than 1, there's no analog that I know of for harmonic functions. Well, I'm sure there must exist something. But certainly doesn't follow from that standard theory. So if 0 is less than p equal to less than 1, then f is equal to b h to the whatever it was, 2 over p, where, or was it p over 2? I cannot possibly remember it. P over 2? 2 over P? Where H is in H2. Well, this is already quite miraculous, as you can see, because NF, the non-tangential maximal function, is certainly, well, the B is bounded by 1, so it's certainly equal to or less than the non-tangential maximal function of H to the 2 over P. And NF, n to the p, is equal to or less than NH squared. And since the case p equals 2 and H is in H2 showed us that NH is in LP, so this is in L1, that implies NF is in LP. And the boundary behavior is just as easy because of this factorization. Also, B star and H star exist implies F star exists. Okay, we showed that the radial limits for a Blaschka product were 1 almost everywhere. But the theory of the Poisson integral says that, in fact, the non-tangential limits exist almost everywhere. They have to have the same value. So, You're saying that this theory of the Poisson integral extends the radial stuff a little bit to a bigger cone. Then I think everything is just, everything but this. And this should be easy, but I can't remember how to do it now. So also, this implies F star exists, and of course, as we mentioned before, F star, if it exists, is certainly going to be an LP because NF certainly dominates it. NF is the max, F star is the limit. So then, remains to prove two things. This important formula and the Cauchy and Poisson representations. Sorry. So it is quite easy. It's embarrassingly easy. But that's the blindness you face up here. Okay. So we know that F tends to F star non-tangentially. In particular, FR tends to F star point-wise. I mean, the radial convergence. And NF was introduced precisely so that you would have an umbrella function for the dominated convergence theorem. That's it. So that's the dominated convergence theorem. And then we have maybe call it star. Star follows from dominated convergence theorem, and then finally we have that F sub R, if the Cauchy and Poisson integrals certainly apply if you dilate F a little bit, so let me just make sure I get the formulas right. So FR at Z is equal to the Cauchy integral of FR at Z, which is FR EIT 1 minus ITZ DT. Okay, it's usually you put the E to the IT here and you have derivative of E to the IT with an I there. This is another way of writing it. And the same thing with the Poisson integral of FR. And the Poisson integral is I to pi, just write PZEIT for a minute, FR EIT DT, where the Poisson integral is this familiar formula. EIT is, of course, the real part, E to the IT plus Z, E to the IT minus Z, which is 1 minus Z squared over E to the IT minus Z squared. And I guess the other thing we need to know later, but we may not need to know it right now, is N equals zero, minus infinity to plus infinity r to the n e to the that I have to introduce the argument for z. Actually there's another s in here. Sorry, yeah, that's for z. If z equals r EI theta. Right. I think that's right. I'm not copying it. It's just from memory. My memory is horrible. Something like that. Okay, so now what do you do? Well, you just use the formula for P equals 1, this star for P equals 1. And for every fixed Z, you let R go to 1 and you get the formulas. So now, fixed Z, let R go to 1, star. So you still have the representation because it's convergence in the L1 norm, and of course the the other kernels here for a fixed Z in the disk, these are certainly bounded functions. Okay, so that finishes the proof of our boundary behavior. There's only one theorem left, but I guess it's 5 minutes to go. I should leave it. That's the FNM Ries theorem. It's real simple now. We want to show that if you have a complex measure on the boundary and you look at the if in this complex measure has all of its negative Fourier coefficients vanishing, then in fact that measure has to be absolutely continuous. And the proof is, if the negative Fourier coefficients vanish, then the Cauchy integral turns out to be a holomorphic function, and you're actually in H1 because it's a complex measure. The variation of the measure is finite. So you actually get a function in H1. But we just finished proving that an H1 function is given by the Poisson integral of its L1 boundary values. And therefore, the L1 boundary values, F star, must be coincide with the measure mu. And it's absolutely conditional. Anyways, I probably said it a little wrong. We'll get it right afterwards. So we'll take a 10-minute break. The FNM Ries theorem is the last theorem that I want to do in this section because we don't need the inner-outer factorization yet. So for the rest of the time, I think we'll just very, very rapidly go through Hilbert spaces and the completeness theorems, the uniform boundedness, the open mapping, closed graph. I kind of get the feeling that everybody knows these things, but we'll go through it quickly anyways. And then we can leave it behind and not have to do it again. So we'll go offline. Okay, so the FNM Riesz theorem, the only part of the proof that I said wrong before the break was that we want to use the Poisson integral and not the Cauchy integral. Apart from that, everything I said was incorrect. So suppose mu is a complex, let's just make it Borel, measure on T. Such that mu hat n, which is e to the minus int d mu t, is 0 for n strictly less than 0. Well, we'll see if that's the one that works. I think that's it. Then mu is absolutely continuous with respect to d theta. So the proof is to look at the Poisson integral of mu and to use that last formula, which I do believe is correct. I just looked at it. So let let's just compute, I guess. Compute. P mu of z is the sum n equals minus infinity to plus infinity of whatever is over there. R I don't really want to use R. Let me put S pi theta there. Then it's S to the n e to the I n theta e to the minus I n t. D mu t. Yeah, I just plugged in R equals S and just wrote the rest of it out. And then this thing vanishes for n negative. So all you have is the sum from n equals 0 to infinity, which is what we wanted, of and the definition of that thing, of course, without this here, generally called u hat at the integer n. And then we have just s to the, now you can take the absolute values off the n and you just get s ei theta to the n. So you get a power series. So it's obviously holomorphic function, s ei theta. We have that the Poisson integral of mu z is in H1. So of course that's to be expected. The condition that the negative Fourier coefficients vanish means that you ought to get a power series in the complex variable SEI theta, and of course you're going to get H1 because mu is a complex measure, has finite total variation. So we have that since, and then you just write out the integral of P mu R, I don't know how to write that out. And if we put this inside okay, I won't be able to. It's equal to a less than. It's got to be that. So let me leave that as an exercise. Somewhere in there, if you put the absolute values in your case, it's got to be the total No. Maybe I should... Actually, I'm confused by what I wrote. So I use that formula. So you use a different formula to get this. That's all. You just use a different formula. this formula. This one will work because this one has total integral 1. It's an L1 function when you divide by 2 pi. It integrates to 1. So you use that formulation. Okay. So I knew there had, you know, I looked at it and didn't see what was going on. So this is equal to or less than. And then this is the Poisson integral at R Z. Okay, so this would be Rf Ei theta. Then you put in that thing, and so you get 1 minus the modulus squared I probably shouldn't be doing this. E to the I T minus I theta, because I still will get confused. So this is the integral on the inside. That's positive. And then we have to put the d mu somewhere. And the d mu of t, and put the absolute value, the variation of mu, and then put the d theta. So now what you do is you integrate in the theta first, and then you're done. So you write this the other way around. I'll just write now, use Fubini, and the fact that if you integrate 1 minus Rs squared over e to the it minus this may not still be quite right. I'm getting confused with the if I put this over there. It's the theta and the t, it's symmetric in the spine. Okay, so that proves, which implies that the H1 norm, p mu, is equal to or less than, as I said, the total variation of the measure mu. Okay, so now we use the meat of the corollary we just proved about boundary values. Remember, we had to use the special factorization of H1 as a product of H2 functions to conclude that an H1 function is the Poisson integral of its L1 boundary values. But the previous corollary implies then that this P of U at Z, that's the REI theta, is equal, P mu of Z is equal to the Poisson integral of, let me write it like this, F star Z, where I've just written F of Z for P mu of Z. Right, this is a holomorphic function in H1, I just call it F. It has boundary limits existing almost everywhere. They're an L1 function, and you can recover this guy from the L1 boundary values. So now, d mu theta, or d mu t, equals F star t dt by uniqueness of Poisson representation of measures. Finite measures or complex measures. I mean, this is also a complex measure. It just happens to be absolutely continuous. And for that, So, uniqueness. Why does uniqueness hold? Well, what we would like to do, of course, is show that if you have a measure, okay, let's just say let mu equal mu minus f star, or d nu is d mu minus f star dt, then the Poisson integral of nu is identically zero. Because that's what we do. We'd like to conclude nu equals zero, i.e., the integral over t of, oh, I shouldn't use f now, use g, dit, d nu t, zero for all g continuous. Right? That will do it. And to get this, we use the fact that if we take the Poisson integral of a continuous function, we actually get a function uniformly continuous on the whole closed disk. And so limits are easy to take. And we would like to somehow, so in other words, we're just going to apply this to GR. So fix G continuous and note that if G of Z is the Poisson extension, so there's no confusion here, because when G is continuous, it extends to a continuous function on the closed disk. So, I mean, it's actually a continuous extension. And it turns out to, of course, be harmonic inside the open disk. So note that if G Z equals that, then if we integrate, maybe I should put 1 over 2 pi here, integrate GR, GR of Z times how do I do this? Better do it like this. Poisson integral of that R that thing integrated against d mu t. So it's not quite g, it's the Poisson extension pushed inside a bit, integrated. But here, once you have the Poisson kernel is symmetric in the thetas and the t's, and you can push it over onto the mu with the r there. So this, by Fubini, is exactly the same thing as doing it the other way around. You get the integral of g e to the i t plus an integral of, oh, this should be nu. This should be nu now. Plus an integral of nu sub r e i t dt. That's because in the Poisson integral for g, you have a dt, and then that's what comes out in the Fubini. And you do it the other way around. And the Poisson kernel by symmetry just goes over to hit that. Now we use the fact that the Poisson integral of nu is identically zero inside the disk. Remember, we're just doing all our action on a circle of radius r here. So this is identically zero. And now we use the uniform continuity of the Poisson extension on the closed disk. If you let r go to 1, this tends to g d nu. Right, because this is uniform convergence. And you finally get what we want. Okay, so that's the whole thing. And as I said before, we'll stop doing the HP theory here. What's next is to introduce what are called inner functions and outer functions. That will come up in the operator theory more. An inner function, by definition, is a bounded holomorphic function whose modulus on the boundary is 1 almost everywhere. So Blaschka products are examples. But there are other functions whose modulus is 1 almost everywhere. basically you can take the if you take the Poisson kernel, remember the Poisson kernel is the real part of something, holomorphic. If you use that holomorphic thing as your kernel and you integrate a Borel, a complex measure, you're of course going to get a function that's holomorphic in the interior. And the complex measure will split into a singular part and an absolutely continuous part. And the singular part gives you functions with modulus 1 almost everywhere that are not Blaschke products. So the singular part, you know, the real part of that kernel is the Poisson kernel. The Poisson kernel on a singular measure is going to go to 0 almost everywhere because the convergence for harmonic functions is to the absolutely continuous part of the measure. So the singular measure, it's 0 boundary values. When you take the exponential of that, you get 1. So these are other examples of things that are also what are called unimodular on the disk there, or on the boundary. And then they're not Blaschke products. However, those are the only ones. What's left over is the other stuff in that formula. They're called other functions. And we need that factorization later, along with Gerling's theorem, that characterizes the invariant subspaces of the shift operator. And the shift operator viewed on the integers, or at least on the non-negative integers, where the holomorphic functions live, while the operator itself is trivial there, to see what the invariant subspaces are is impossible. And going to this representation with the power series, you can suddenly compute them. But that's another story. We don't need that yet. So instead, let's go to some functional analysis. Okay. So maybe a word about, so I asked Jason to put on the web Appendix A, which is functional analysis. So I should explain where these things are coming from. So I have this, it's been changed a lot. So there's about 250 pages of stuff I've written out. However, I didn't write, and I started doing this in December, so I obviously didn't do it all. Much of it has been taken from other things I've written. So I've had other courses where I have notes, like functional analysis. So the functional analysis part has been imported from another course, one I gave in Perugia a couple of years ago, on functional analysis. It was a more elementary thing. But since the notes are there, I just decided to borrow parts of them at places. Those notes are fairly polished. I mean, they've been around for a while. They've gone through proofreadings. Much of what comes later in that also comes from, you know, papers that I have written. I have tech files for other things where things are relatively polished. The parts of this document that were written since the beginning of, since about halfway through December, are the first two chapters, the one that you've already been given on interpolating sequences, and the Appendix C on HP theory. That's why those are riddled with errors, because they haven't been proofread yet. It's happening right now as I go along. But this part, I think, is relatively free of errors. But the other stuff is getting corrected, and then it will, I hope, improve as we leave the stuff that I rushed through December to create. Okay, so functional analysis. What I want to do here is basically just review the main theorems, not even with explicit proofs, because they're really simple. They're all written out explicitly, easy to follow. I just want to state the results and draw the pictures. So just to remind everybody, including me, of how the intuition goes. Okay, so we have a Hilbert space H. Of course, you're given, well, first of all, an inner product space. You have an inner product, which has all the usual things. You take its complex conjugate, it's the same as flipping the points. It's linear here, conjugate linear there. It defines a norm. If you take the square root of xx, all those things, I take everybody knows those. And, of course, if it's complete, then we call it Hilbert space. But in an inner product space, there are at least three formulas that are crucial, that we can follow their development through the rest of the theory. There's the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. y in Hilbert space. It just follows algebraically from the axioms using quadratic minimization thing. So there's the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. The other one is the orthogonality inequality. And, okay, so the only Hilbert space we can draw on the blackboard is this Hilbert space. It's either a one-dimensional Hilbert space, the scalar, that's too trivial. So we'll view it as a real Hilbert space. So incidentally, in this course, all Hilbert spaces are complex valued, except when we want to prove the Hahn-Banach theorem, then they're real, but then they go back to being complex later. But of course, you can do a theory of real Hilbert spaces too, which not quite as rich, but you can do it. Anyway, we'll use it for our pictures. So if you have a vector x and another vector y, then the first important thing is that if you look at the space generated by x, y will be perpendicular to x, meaning the inner product is zero, if and only if the length of y is actually equal to or less than the shortest distance. I mean, so it looks like it has to be. Okay, so in other words, this norm of y, or xy is perpendicular if and only if norm of y equal to or less than the norm of all these distances. So y minus lambda x for all lambda in C. Okay, so that's a nice characterization of orthogonality that carry through. And the third one is, third inequality is the parallelogram law, which just says the obvious thing. It says that, what does it say? It says that the length of this squared plus the length of that squared is equal to the length of this squared plus that squared plus that squared plus that squared. And so from those simple properties in an inner product space, which is nothing but algebra, a little min problem there, nothing but algebra, then what happens? Oh yeah, then we get the following theorem, which is of course the crux of Hilbert spaces. If E is convex closed, so what's a typical convex closed set? Well, that's not typical, but it comes up. It's a subspace translated over. So this is closed, convex, and every closed convex set has a unique element of minimal norm. So there exists unique x and e of minimal norm. And of course the proof, which we won't give, let me just draw another convex set. There's another choice of e. And of course the well-known trick is you pick a sequence of points in E whose norms converge to the ints of such norms. So you get a sequence that ought to converge to a point that looks like that. And the way that you get the convergence is by applying the parallelogram law here, noting that half of this point can still be in the set E. And I won't go through that. But that simple little thing gives you this useful fact, which we can now immediately turn into something much more useful. First, with complementary spaces. So we get the following theorem from this one. If M is a closed subspace of H, and if M perp is the set of all vectors y such that x equals 0 for all x in M. So that's the set of things which are perpendicular to everything in M. then the conclusion is that H is M direct sum M perp. And of course the picture is entirely obvious. That's M. Then, of course, the things which are always perpendicular should look like this. And every element should be uniquely representable as something in M plus something in, M perp. And everything is trivial to prove except for the fact that these two guys add up to all of H. The fact that their intersection is zero is trivial. But the fact that they add up to all of H uses this this theorem. And I guess the idea is you look at X. Again, we won't prove it, but we'll just draw the picture. Now, this is supposed to be parallel. X minus M. And then in this space, there is an element here which is closest to the origin. And that has to be of the form x minus little m, for some little m in there. But also, since it's the element of least norm, it exists, it's the E least norm, the orthogonality property in an inner product space says it must be orthogonal. So you get that x minus m equals m perp in here. So it's just instant. And then, the final... The final statement in this rapid review is the Riesz theorem that identifies continuous linear functionals. It is just as easy as all of this. So the theorem is that if lambda y of x is defined to be this, then the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality tells you right away that lambda y is a continuous linear functional on H. That just means that it's, it's a linear map from H. The fact that it's functional means it's into the scalar field, so it's a linear map from H to the scalar field. The fact that it's continuous means bounded. lambda is in H star, and lambda y, the norm of the operator, which is its bound, which is the sup of lambda yx over the norm of x, again by the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, you easily see that that's equal to or less than y. What I'm saying could have been said before the statement of the theorem. So if lambda y, then of course lambda y is in fact, the map that sends y to lambda y, so y is in H, lambda y is in H star, it's actually a conjugate linear isometry onto. So it is a conjugate linear isometry onto. So obviously one-to-one preserves length onto H star. Most of this is fairly routine. The onto part is the only one that really requires some effort, and it follows from the previous stuff. So since this is a really important theorem, we may as well just go through the simple proof. We just prove onto. So suppose you have a lambda in H star. If lambda is not the identically zero functional, zero, then the null space, which is lambda inverse of 0, is, well, first of all, since it's a bounded linear functional, this is closed, and it's not going to be everything. So is a proper closed subspace of H. And the fact that it's proper, one thing to do is to use this last theorem. The last theorem implies in particular is that M perp is non-empty. There's got to be something perpendicular to all of this. So my previous theorem, there exists, and draw a new picture. So the null space, of our continuous functional is like this. So of course, what we expect, that's the set where it vanishes. So it ought to be 1, 2, 3, etc. Well, it would be the level sets. So somewhere on this perpendicular set, there is a point, some non-zero point z. Presumably, by correctly choosing it along here, we can get a representation for lambda as inner product with something. So by the previous theorem, there exists z in N perp. And now, for x and h, so we pick an arbitrary x and h, and we want to see what lambda does to it. Then there's this little algebraic trick that if you don't think of it, you can think for an hour fussing with it, but once it's been pointed out to you, it's hard to forget it. And that is that if you look at these two vectors, if you multiply the vector z by lambda of x, and you multiply x by lambda of z, they both have the same lambda value by linearity. And so what does that say? That says that lambda x times z minus lambda z times x is in the null space because lambda of it just cancel. Therefore, because z is perpendicular, you get that z dot with this is 0, and that gives it to you. You're done. So I guess part of the reason I wanted to review the Hilbert space theory was just to remind myself and everybody how incredibly simple it is once you put it together right. I mean, Hilbert space theory is just kind of amazing. It's like complex variables. You put it together right, and lots of stuff happens very quickly with apparently little effort, although if you don't think to do these things, you can spend a lot of time thinking about it. So this implies that 0 is the inner product of this with z. So if I inner product with z, oh, okay, lambda. Okay, lambda maps h to the complex numbers. So lambda of x is a complex number. Z, x and z are just elements of the Hilbert space. And so that's in the Hilbert space. So basically, lambda x z, and some point up here, sorry, that's lambda z x, and in the same coset, is lambda x z. I mean, we don't know that until you actually write it out and compute lambda of it, but that's what we're doing. We're taking them both to the same coset. And then, because z's perpendicular, you get what? You get that lambda x times the norm of z squared, which is z dot z, minus, then you get lambda z, and then of course you get the inner product, which you want, and you now solve, because z is non-zero. I should have said that. I think I did. There exists z not zero. And then you get lambda x is equal to lambda z norm z squared. So if you put it inside, it's lambda z bar, because it's conjugate linear, over z squared z. So finally, that the y. So it all works out very cute, but obviously very useful to know that every continuous linear functional has to come from the obvious thing, inner product, even in a completely abstract Hilbert space. Okay, so now start the completeness theorems. Maybe in the last 7 minutes today I'll just remind you, because again, this is the cornerstone of all three of these completeness theorems, is of course Baer's theorem. It's really simple. Maybe we'll just draw the picture proof of it, and then next Thursday we'll rapidly go through the three consequences of Baer's theorem. But let's at least do Baer's theorem today. So this is now leaving Hilbert spaces. So in fact, we now momentarily go back to Banach spaces, which don't have inner products on them. They just have norms and a linear structure, and they're complete, etc. So Baer's theorem says, suppose I guess X is either a complete metric space or locally compact Hausdorff space. Either one of those two. We mainly use this one, but I throw this one in because it's the same proof. If we ever need it, it's there. Suppose that if Gn is a sequence of open dense subsets of X, then the intersection not only non-empty, dense in X. So the common thing that, so of course generally you refer to such a set, a countable intersection of open sets, as a G-delta set. And basically this will tell us that the intersection of G-deltas that are dense is still G-delta that's dense. And you can also flip this around the other way, and this causes me grief sometimes. But this, I'll see if I can say it in words once. So this says that countable intersection of open, dense sets is still dense. If you complement that, it says that the countable union of closed sets without any interior, closed sets with no interior is still has no interior. Okay, yeah, see, I'm already confused, but I'll look at my notes when I come to that sort of thing. Always a source of because when you go back and forth in the applications, you have to do that. Null sets are closed, and you take countable unions of them, and they cover a big set, and you have, therefore. Okay, so the proof, we can just do it with a picture. So, it suffices to show that the intersection of Gn into infinity intersect a ball or an open set V0. The second case doesn't have balls. It is non-empty for all open V0. Right? That just says there's a bit of air everywhere in the dense setting. So, well, let's draw the picture. So let's suppose that, we'll draw it as if it's a ball, that's in the first case. But that's our open set B naught. And then you look at G1. G1 is an open dense set. So G1 certainly has some open part which intersects with B1. And what we can do is find an open, oh, this is B0. We can do is find an open set B1. So B1 will be contained in, actually we'll make its closure contained in, B0 intersect G1. That's clear. You can do that in either cases. And then here's the part where they distinguish. And in case one, you want to make sure that the diameter of B1 is going to get small. So let's say 1 over 1. And in the second case, all you want to be able to do is make sure that that's compact. So B1 bar is compact. Well, you can now just continue this, right? And you get B2, such that B2 bar is contained in G2 intersect B1. Right? You just do it again. So the next time you have a little bit of G2 that intersects B1, you just pick a B2 in there whose closure is in there. And the same thing again. So I'll just put here diameter less than, say, 1 over n. Or in the second case, just always want them compact. The reason for these two things is that when you take the intersection of the Bn bars, they'll be non-empty for different reasons, but they'll be non-empty. And, of course, that point that is non-empty is contained in B0. That's all there is to it. So then the intersection of Bn bar from 1 to infinity is not the empty set, and it is contained in both B0 and in the infinite intersection, because it's contained in all the Gn's by construction. Okay, so that simple Bayer's theorem will have some enormous consequences if I can figure out how to take the logical complement of that statement. But I will rehearse it for next Thursday. We'll do it quickly, though. I have a feeling everybody knows this stuff from the looks on people's faces. Anyways, now on Tuesday we have the factorization, and we still don't have the open mapping theorem and closed graph theorem, but we'll be able to finish the interpolation proof, certainly the duality proof, and we'll start Peter Jones's proof, and probably won't finish it, but finish it the next week and start the Corona theorem proof.